If you don't, it still interferes with the system. With that, I'm going to open the House Committee on Human Services today on February 11th, 2011. And we are going to open up an informational hearing from the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Glad you're here. Take a seat as you'd like.
Okay.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Suzanne Hoffman. I'm the Chief of Staff of Bruce Goldberg at the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority. And I've been asked to just speak with you briefly this morning to talk with you about the process that we've been going through for about the last year and a half to become two agencies. As you know, at the conclusion of the last legislative session, House Bill 2009 created the Oregon Health Authority. And what you have in front of you are three pretty simple basic slides that I hope will give you a picture of where we were, where we are, are intended to be by the end of this biennium, when we officially become two, and a little bit about the services that we're going to share between these two agencies in order to maintain the quality and efficiency that we've been striving toward in our transformation initiative over these past few years. So the very first slide shows you what the agencies involved in both DHS and the Oregon Health Authority looked like before House Bill 2009. So you can see the Department of Human Services contained all of those elements, divisions, and services. And then the four boxes on the upper right, the Public Employees Benefit Board, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and the Office of Private Health Partnerships were four separate small agencies all having to do with health in the state of Oregon. So through the transition to becoming two separate entities, the Department of Human Services contains still children, adults, and families, which of course are child welfare programs, self-sufficiency and food stamp or public welfare programs, as well as our vocational rehabilitation division. And then, of course, all the programs that serve seniors and people with disabilities remain in what will be the new DHS. And under the oversight of the Oregon Health Policy Board, the Oregon Health Authority contains all of those components listed on the bottom right. I think in the wisdom of this body and others in the state pointed out as a part of this process, the risk of becoming inefficient and spending more money than necessary, when you take one agency and you make it two, you tend to create duplicate administrative types of services. So we were directed by the legislature as a part of that bill to see what we could do to share as many administrative services between these two agencies as possible, which is what we have done. It made a lot of sense because not only would it cost a lot of money to separate out all of our information technology systems and all of our financial and accounting systems, but it really wouldn't have worked very well for the people who are doing the jobs in the agency, for the many providers and partners we work with, and it wouldn't have served families well in Oregon. So lots of good reasons to keep sharing these administrative services between the two agencies. On the second slide, it shows you basically the choices that we made. And as simple as this looks, believe me, we went through quite a bit of analysis and careful thought in making these choices. And so what we will have is all the shared services on the second page will actually serve both of these agencies. Structurally speaking, all the offices on the left side will sit within the DHS organizational structure, and the offices listed on the right-hand side will sit in the Oregon Health Authority organizational structure. We really could have placed them in either one, but through analysis of which agency uses these services the most, which are more operational in nature, which are more strategic in nature, what kind of innovations are going to be coming along that might make it better to place one office in one agency than another in a way that would we could leverage that innovation to serve both really well, we landed in this place. And on the very last page, I think really the ultimate question that I think you all had asked, which resulted in this presentation today, is how are these two agencies going to work well together? And that is going to be through a formal joint governance model. So even though certainly these two agencies will have their own leadership teams and they'll meet separately as they need to do to do the work and meet their missions, we also will have a lot of joint policy decision-making and a lot of joint operational management to do in order to do this really well. So we will have two groups, a joint policy steering committee made up of a small group of the top leaders of the organization, and a joint operations steering committee to manage all of those shared administrative services. And actually, this is an opportunity to do this much better than we've done it in the past, in that we will have formalized agreements, charters for each group, memorandum of understanding about how these agencies are going to work well together, signed by both directors of both agencies when those are appointed, and also a service level agreements for every one of those administrative services. So whether it's information technology or whether it's contracts and procurement, whether it's human resources, we will establish service level agreements so every internal customer, so to speak, in the organization knows exactly what they're paying for, exactly what they're getting, and can make choices about quality and level of service. So that sounded really simple, but really we've been working through it for about the last year and a half. We've had many, many teams of technical staff working on making sure that we do this all very well so that nothing breaks in the process. For any of you who were around in the early 2000-2001, we had a major reorganization of the Department of Human Resources. And in some ways, we didn't manage it maybe as well as we're managing this today. We learned a lot from that experience in terms of some of the technical things that can go wrong when you're making those kind of major changes in a complicated organizational structure like ours. So we've managed this one very carefully using all of our transformation resources, applying project management. Our lean efforts to create efficiency have been a part of this, and we're on track to have everything done on time and, most importantly, within budget by the end of this biennium.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any questions?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for being here. And when we hear efficiency and cost savings, it's good news in a very otherwise bleak session. Mm-hmm. You talk in terms of the future. Just tell me a little bit about when you see this coming together. I mean, I don't know where we are mm-hmm. on a calendar for the process.
Yeah, well, officially we become two at the end of this biennium. So we were given this biennium essentially 2 years to get all of the mechanics done to be able to officially become two agencies within all of the state systems that need to recognize us that way by the end of this biennium. And we're on track for that to happen. That said, what Dr. Goldberg was really committed to was not just waiting until the end of this biennium, flipping a switch and expecting everything to work perfectly. So we've been moving into this step by step as we've gotten every piece done. So, for example, the goal really from what he charged us with was let's start behaving like two agencies in January of this year because we're going to be presenting two separate budgets as two separate agencies to this body, and we want to be sure that we're well practiced at this and have worked out the bugs, so to speak, by the time we get to the end of the biennium and are actually moving fully into practicing, for example, this joint governance. So we actually are starting to implement this right now. We're working on our service level agreements and have appointed our joint governance bodies, and they'll start meeting this month.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Just going through this, I know it's an overview and everything. Have you done any estimates on how many reduced FTE this is going to be and the cost savings, where the fiscal is going to be of the savings that's going to happen from this program? because, as you know, that's something we're very concerned with this time.
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, I don't know if we're going to have a reduction of FTE or actual cost savings from this. I think what's inherent in creating two agencies out of when where one existed is normally you're going to have increased cost. What we have tried to do through this effort is minimize that or eliminate it entirely. And basically the commitment was that whatever we have to create to operate as two instead of one, that we would do so in the most efficient way that we could in order to do it within our existing budget. I think where we're going to have reduced FTE and savings is really over the fact that we've been in a hiring freeze for some time related to the current budget situation. So where we've created flexibility there is really more through attrition as staff have left and we've not replaced them in many cases, and through making different decisions about where to place our resources, both as we are in the midst of the hiring freeze and also through our transformation efforts. So if we improve a process and create efficiency in one area and are able to move some of those resources to another area that needs them, that's how we've been able to manage through this economic crisis, as opposed to coming back to this body and asking for more people or more resources, which we know is not feasible at this time.
Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Good morning, committee chairs Tomei and Gilliam. My name is Richard Harris, and I'm the assistant director for addictions and mental health in the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to talk a little bit and be brief, as requested, about the community mental health service system. And I've asked our superintendent, Greg Roberts, from the Oregon State Hospital to talk about the other major responsibility of addictions and mental health, which is the operation of the Oregon State Hospital. So I think that most people have a pretty fundamental understanding about the kinds of problems that people with addictions and mental health face, but just a couple of things. Addiction and mental health problems affect one in four individuals in our community. So all of you, as well as those of us in the audience, have and know people who have been affected by some level of mental health problem or some level of addiction problem. It's not a problem that belongs to somebody else. It belongs to all of us. The state of Oregon has responsibilities to see that. In fact, we have an array of services in our communities to deal with both of these issues. And one of the major reasons why addictions and mental health was included in the formation of the new health authority was a basic understanding that addiction and mental health is one of the major cost drivers in our healthcare system, and it needs to be included in the major healthcare delivery system in such a way that it's not isolated or siloed and functioning all by itself. So the efforts of the Oregon Health Authority are completely in line with the mission of the Addictions and Mental Health Division within it. So we welcome the changes that were brought about by the last legislature to include addictions and mental health. And there will obviously be more changes as we work our way through this legislature in terms of how that health system is fully integrated with addictions and mental health. The mission for addictions and mental health really is to make sure that we optimize health and mental health and the healthy lifestyles so people who may have addiction problems can return and recover and get back into their families and their community. And we have some major goals, which I'm not going to go through all of them, but I think it's important to understand that our goals in addiction and mental health are in alignment with the goals of the Oregon Health Authority, which are usually typified in a discussion of what's called the triple aim. And what we want to do is make sure that we have quality of care, the patient experience produces the right kinds of outcomes, that you improve the health of the community and of individuals, and at the same time you find ways to reduce the cost of health care. And so we believe that including addictions and mental health in the general health care will have the effect in time of reducing the overall costs of health care. There's numerous examples about untreated addiction or mental illness and how expensive it becomes when it is treated in its later stages or treated in the medical system. So, you know, the examples of cirrhosis of the liver, a liver transplant, which is a multi-million-dollar affair. If addiction were addressed early on, you would not have that rate of cirrhosis. Mental illness the same way. We have examples in our mental health system where we are pushing forward for early intervention with young adults and kids so that we know that if you catch early signs of psychosis and provide the right level of treatment, that it does not develop into full-blown schizophrenia that may be then be treated in acute care hospitals and in state hospitals, or and the damage that occurs to people and communities when it's gone undetected. So the effort really is to intervene earlier. We have other examples in the alcohol and drug system where, in partnership with the Children and Family Services, we have developed a system of treatment that is being targeted to families who have kids that are in stress in the child protective system and in the adult or in the Children and Families Division, where family members get treatment early. I was talking yesterday to one of the providers that provides residential treatment services for moms with kids and pregnant early in their pregnancy. This was a program that was started here in Oregon almost 22 years ago, and that initial program called the Lydia Owings Center, there have now been 231 drug-free babies born to the mothers in that treatment program. A drug-addicted delivery in a hospital of an infant is an extremely expensive operation. This program has saved millions of dollars over the year because it's a managed to get moms clean and sober before they deliver. The big part about it, though, is that it fits in with a joint program between Children and Families and the Mental Health Division. The system for mental health and addiction services, the state operates only the state hospitals. The rest of the services are provided in the community by generally nonprofit, but sometimes county-operated programs across the state that deliver the services and under contract, usually to the counties or to the mental health managed care organizations. So what AMH does is that we manage the contracts to the counties, we manage to support the system in terms of making sure we're reporting the information and following individuals. It's really important to understand that in our efforts to better manage the system, we're constantly in the process of making some changes to this. And one of those items is going to be discussed later today, which is how we manage residential care for people with mental illness in the community and how it's aligned with the other services. So it's a partnership between the counties and providers in the community, and we are the entity that has responsibility to make sure we get the funds there for people to do the services they need. There is a little handout I presented to you. I won't go through this in detail, but it gives you the number of individuals in our state that we believe have the need for publicly funded mental health and addiction services. And that's on this chart here. The first column is the really numbers drawn from prevalence studies about what the nature of the number of people who are affected by mental illness and addiction, both adults and kids, as well as the gambling programs. And then in the more middle column, you see how many people are being served on an annual basis. And it is a little discouraging to see that we're in general serving less than half the need for mental health and addiction services in the community. And this is a troublesome statistic, and it's It's the way I have of demonstrating that we haven't made the level of commitment to solve these problems that we should be making, and that through some changes in the Oregon Health Authority and integrating mental health and addiction services, my hope is that we can increase the percentages here of the number of people that we can successfully treat in the community. So there are a variety of providers around the state. There's approximately 200 individual providers across the state that provide mental health services to adults and kids. And there's approximately 200 additional alcohol and drug programs, both residential, detox, and outpatient, as well as about 150 to 175 DUI providers across the state. In addition, the state has responsibilities for the prevention programs. Prevention is, by and large, handled at community level and county level, and there are a variety of different kinds of prevention activities. Very little state funding goes into this. It's mostly federal block grant dollars that we use for prevention. Alcohol and drug treatment services include outpatient, residential, and detoxification. Then there are a number of special programs like the Children's Initiative with kids in combination with the Department of Children and Families, as well as some of the residential programs for moms and kids. We have problem gambling programs that provide both outpatient and one program that provides a residential treatment for people with gambling issues. Those programs are, in many respects, an envy of other communities funded across the country, but it's funded by gambling dollars, and there's a set aside in the gambling fund to help finance those dollars so it doesn't come out of general fund. Our mental health system is somewhat more complicated and has a larger budget, and it's really directed to various service components. So we have a system of acute care services that are located in hospitals in most communities across the state. We have a state hospital system that is for those individuals who need that level of care in the community. And then there are a variety of residential programs, about 1,700 beds across the state in a sort of a tiered system of residential care that includes everything from foster care to 16-bed secure residential facilities sited in various parts of the state. In addition, we manage with outpatient services, and we also manage crisis services that are provided locally. Our partners, the counties, utilize the general fund and some federal dollars that we pass on down to them. But in addition, much of our system is also financed through Medicaid dollars that are managed in our Division of Medical Assistance Programs under the Oregon Health Plan. So there's a variety of ways we do the funding, and we have responsibility to license, certify individuals as well as programs across the state. So I think I'd really like to just turn this over to Greg to discuss the state hospital system.
Thank you for coming. Thank you, Richard. Let me see if there are any questions for Richard before we move on. This is sort of a high elevation look at what's happening here, and we'll get into the weeds later. Representative, go ahead.
Thank you. Do you have, do you have information on relapse and recidivism rates, or however you want to term it, for drug treatment categories?
Thompson, Chairs Tomei and Gilliam. In the last legislature, this question came up a lot, you know, how many people are clean and sober, and as a result of the frustration around finding that number out, because I know it's a concern to a lot of people, we commissioned a study to be done. We're 6 months into that longitudinal study because we're asking these questions of what are the outcomes of treatment. And so that report can be made available to all of you. It's online, and we'll make sure you get a copy of it. It's very encouraging. Results of treatment are, in many ways, much better, I think, than people understand. And so I don't want to be quoting numbers out of my head from that, but I would love to get that to you.
Okay.
We expect the study to be done probably before the legislature is over with, but we wanted those numbers to be available for discussion during the session, so I'll make that study available.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up?
Just a comment. One of my concerns specifically is I've done some work with a couple of different treatment programs, and it appears to me we're missing the mark on meth treatment. In those programs, we seem to have pretty good results of people graduating out in marijuana and prescription drugs and whatnot, but the meth people were just right back at it again. It's a very small sample. But I'm starting to question whether or not we have the right program for meth, and if we're spending money on meth treatment, whether or not we're spending money on meth treatment, that's just not getting us results. And we need to go back to the drawing boards on that particular piece. So,
well, I believe, Representative Thompson, that you'll find some information in this report specifically about that.
Thank you.
Representative Harper, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully this isn't down-in-the-weeds type question. If it is, we'll blow by it and come back to it later. 1% of lottery funds is dedicated by statute, I think, or constitution, to treat gambling addiction, correct? Which in 2009-11 was estimated to be $1 billion coming into the lottery, so $1 million?
It's actually about 11.1.
Okay. Wasn't sure if that was the exact same figure, if that was all lottery funds there. But we're serving 1,756 people on this table. That's not the number of people that get treated for that amount of money, is it?
Those funds go to gambling prevention activities as well. So, no, that's not just the treatment dollars.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for asking that question. I think that's an issue that we've been dealing with for some years to make sure that we're actually getting all of those funds, which the public said that they wanted us to provide for prevention. I've got one more question, if I may. So thanks and continue bringing it up. Thank you. Representative.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am curious about the dual diagnosis issues you have with the numbers that you have here, the addiction and the mental health. I know that there's quite an overlap, or can be an overlap. If at some point you could get that information, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Frederick would be glad to provide more detailed information about dual diagnosed individuals. It's kind of a complicated issue because some people have multiple diagnoses and problems, and some have more mental illness than addiction, and some have more addiction issues than mental illness. So there's a great variation in how this works. I can give you that breakdown is in a later time.
Thank you. I'd appreciate it.
And we will be inviting Richard back probably several times during this session. Yes, Representative Thompson, did you have a follow-up?
Just a quick comment, question, whatever. We're putting money from the gambling into an addiction program that we're apparently way behind on treatment. And I know this isn't your area, but does it make sense for the Oregon Lottery to be advertising on television to get more people into the lottery when we can't treat the addictions that we have? Is that the state spending money on two ends of the spectrum? Or, I don't expect an answer. I just, I think I got my answer, but, that will be an issue.
We'll follow up on that.
Thank you for raising the issue.
Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sticking on this subject for a minute, the money that the lottery spends, which I also think is another interesting aspect of this, on problem, the warning you about problem gambling, that's totally lottery. That has nothing to do with your department. That's not part of the money that's going to you. You're not a partner in that, so to speak.
Co-Chair Gilley, I believe that's correct. We have prevention activities in our division, and the lottery also has a communications about some of the issues and risks around gambling.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Is there any coordination when they go to communicate and message on that with your department?
There is an advisory committee that includes folks from the lottery on it, and so, yes, there is some coordination.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Since we're discussing lottery and everything here, just real quick, and you may have noticed this or may not have, but when we eliminated smoking from indoor facilities, people stopped playing the lottery machines as much. I've talked to several bar owners, and they've said this. I'm just wondering if you noticed a downturn in gambling addictions when we got rid of smoking in indoor places.
Representative Widener, co-chairs, I believe that the revenues from gambling have been down, and it's a little hard to know whether it was smoking, because it was about the same time that we had a downturn in the economy, and I believe other people who have better knowledge of the way those revenues work probably could answer that question better.
And we will have the lottery commission come in and talk with about
this. Was just more, I was kind of curious if you've noticed the addiction, gambling addictions going down with this as well that you're having to deal with.
We haven't seen any slacking off of the gambling addiction problems.
We can talk further about that. There is a nexus. Thanks for the question. Any further questions? All right. Thank you, Richard. Welcome today.
Hello. Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee. My name is Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital in charge of the Salem campus and Portland campus. I'm here to provide an overview of the state hospital operation and to some extent an update on some important issues. As Mr. Harris mentioned, the state hospital needs to be viewed as one element of a continuum of mental health services in the state that extend into the community and include the state hospital. The state hospital is part of the continuum of care in the system, and we exist to provide care and treatment to patients whose mental illness is so severe that they cannot be treated in a community setting. And the mission of the hospital is to enable the patient to recover sufficiently so that they can return to the community in the shortest possible time. Our population in the state hospital, we generally break down into three categories. Adult treatment services are people who are civilly committed. They're served at the 92-bed Portland campus, and almost always after being initially treated in a community mental health setting and being unable to return to the community at that point, they're involuntarily committed to the state hospital, and that population ranges in age from 18 to 65. Then a separate second portion of our population is in neurogeriatric services. These are people who are also civilly committed due to psychiatric disorders that include dementia, traumatic brain injury, and other mental health diagnoses, and that are often associated with significant medical issues as well. This population is served at the Salem campus and currently occupies three units or wards of the hospital. And third category, the largest category, is the forensic population. And these are people who suffer from mental illness who have been directed to the hospital by the court system. And this forensic population is also broken into two categories, those who are found to be guilty except for insanity, guilty of a crime and sentenced to supervision by the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And then secondly, adults who have been accused of a crime but who have been determined to be not competent to aid and assist their attorney in their defense. And for those individuals, the hospital seeks to provide treatment that enables them to be restored to fitness and to proceed to trial. The current census of the hospital, as you see, is a little under 600. We've been in that range for months and months now. It's a pretty typical population. As you see, the forensic population, the two categories, comprise about 74-75% of the total population. Then we wanted to mention that the United States Department of Justice had visited the hospital to assess the hospital's compliance with a federal legislation called CRIPA. It's usually what it's referred to by its acronym, Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act, which seeks to ensure the civil rights of people who are in nursing homes, institutions of various kinds, including state psychiatric hospitals. There were a number of findings from that visit, which we continue to address. The United States Department of Justice has not gone away. They're still attentive to the issues at the hospital. We have, in my opinion, a robust corrective action plan that has been implemented now for a number of years, and I think has resulted in a number of improvements, especially in the areas that the DOJ had cited. The U.S. DOJ revisited the hospital. This is in July 2009, so it was actually prior to my arrival at the hospital in September 2010. And we focus on the deficiencies that were cited. We report regularly to them at the hospital advisory board in different forums as well. And then the last point I wanted to mention is the status of the hospital replacement project.
Before you move on to that, could you talk some about where we are with the Department of Justice?
In what vein? I'm sorry.
Well, are they looking, are they still criticizing the hospital? Richard looks like he wants to speak to this.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, at the present time, back in December, the U.S. Department of Justice sent a notice to the state of Oregon that they were expanding their investigation to include the community-based services. So we're a little uncertain exactly what that means. They have been and visited, talked to people in the community who have responsibilities for the delivery of services there and who may be advocates and or patients. We're in the process now with our Department of Justice in negotiating a time for them to interview and work with members of the state staff about their concerns. We have interpreted this broadly to be part of a more national trend where the federal government is looking to see that communities have developed the right kind of community-based services so that people can come out of the state hospital and live in a more independent fashion in the community. So we believe that's their focus, but right now we know very little about what their actual interests are, and I'm certain we will in the coming several months get more clarity about what their interests are.
And I just remind the committee that we heard on Wednesday from the seniors and disability community about how Fairview was closed and how the Department of Justice became involved and how that proceeded. And our concerns, of course, is that we don't have that same kind of negative effect on the mental health issues in the state hospital. So, Representative Greenlake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is perplexing when we look at the situation that 75% of the beds are forensic beds, and we're thinking about dealing with a state mental hospital and some rational part of the healthcare system of the state. And this seems like almost a different universe. How as a manager do you deal with the fact that you have people there for reasons that are not necessarily therapeutic anymore, but are there for one other strange reason or another? I even understand that there are some people in there who remain in the hospital beyond what would have been their sentence if they weren't found guilty, being sane or whatever that is. How do you deal with it?
Well, I think the way we look at that is to, as I said, we focus on what the basic mission of the hospital is to provide treatment that helps people in their recovery so that they can return to the community. Whether a person is civilly committed or a forensic patient, that remains the goal. A patient is assessed and they have a treatment plan, and we're to provide that treatment so that they are able to return to the community. In the case of the forensic patients, of course, the process of being discharged involves the psychiatric security review board, and that's an additional factor. But the hospital's responsibility would be to present information to the psychiatric security review board, updating them on the patient's readiness for discharge or progress toward discharge, and then the PSRB makes its decision accordingly. So it doesn't change the basic function of the hospital or anything managerially. All the patients are there to receive treatment that's discharge focused, and then civilly committed people are in a different process than the PSRB patients.
We are going to hear about PSRB.
Yes, we will be hearing about the PSRB. Any further questions? Representative Thompson.
One of the questions I have relative to the community mental health, and I think probably the feds are going to be interested also. When we started releasing people from the state hospital and from Fairview, a lot of them ended up in communities without reasonable community treatment. And the vernacular is the people under the bridge. And that's really a problem throughout the Mid-Valley and probably the Portland metropolitan area too. But in terms of community-based treatment, I'd like to know in the future more about what we're doing to get control of people who have no place to live. They're not getting decent medical and mental health treatment. But they're just on the street. And I think most communities feel the pinch of that. I mean, even the small communities in my district, we have people who are obviously mentally ill that are not in care. And I'm talking to some of the police agencies, they're very concerned about that, as you probably know, and a lot of the people they end up shooting are people that should have been in mental health care, and that exacerbated to something else that turned out to be very unpleasant. So I guess it, overall, I want to know globally, what is community health care? I know we have counties dealing with it, but yet not dealing with it. And what's the problem? What's the solution?
Representative Thompson, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam. I kind of like that question, and I'd like to respond to it, so can I may take a few minutes?
Absolutely.
I like that you like the question.
Well, it's a serious problem, and yeah. I think that's what we're here to try to figure out, what's the better way to handle it. A few years ago, we closed Damish Hospital and the beds there, and states across the country were closing hospital units. And it was really called deinstitutionalization, and Oregon was pretty thoughtful about this because what was done was that we then started creating residential programs in communities to discharge people from the hospital to, so that you didn't send people back to the community to the street just because you closed the beds in the hospital. So the roughly 1,700 beds were created across the state to be able to send people to, and that's a treasure that we have, that we've invested in the facilities to be able to provide places in each community where people have serious mental illness can enter into recovery. Right now, a project we are calling Aim High, which is centered around better utilization management of those 1,700 beds so that we move people to supportive housing in the community, because that's where they will be successful and independent. And being independent is important for people to move to the level where they can manage their disease. So this is a recovery model, and having community-based services is important to do that. So people, when Damage closed, everybody went to some facility. It wasn't that we emptied people to the street. However, The numbers that I gave you earlier, where we are only serving less than half the need, results in many people being not getting services because there just isn't the facility capacity or the community service capacity to deal with those, or the crisis services. So many people end up in our jails because they are exhibiting problems in the community, and they come to the attention of law enforcement, and there are very few tools to do that. So it's an issue I think that we all would like to do better with, and it really is going to require a reordering of the resources so that you have adequate community-based care. When we added new staff to the hospital and built a new hospital, there was a companion report that was done called the Community Services Workgroup Report, which outlined what were the needs to be filled so that you didn't have to send people to the state hospital. So ultimately, a robust community service system will keep people out of more intensive care models, whether they're acute care or whether they're a state hospital. So if we don't make the investments in what community services are, we end up paying down the line in more expensive services. So what we really have to do in the moving forward with the change in an integrated healthcare delivery system is address these issues at community level and earlier on. Otherwise, we end up with having only the very expensive tools to deal with this issue. So I think we know how to get there. We know what to do. And I'm not just saying we just have to dump money onto the system. But the reality of it is that it's going to require a different way of providing these services to people in the community if we're going to be successful.
And I think, Richard, when you're talking about services, you're not just talking about medical care.
Yeah.
You're talking about housing, perhaps supportive employment, all kinds of wraparound services that keep people safe and productive in a community. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
And I know you've got a question, Representative, but I want to ask, Greg, how much does it cost to keep a patient in the hospital a year?
Actually, I don't have that information with me at the moment. We can get that to you, I'm sure.
I've heard a figure of $200,000. Do you think that's anywhere in the ballpark?
Honestly, I don't.
Okay, all right. If you'd
that be your total budget divided by that.
Sorry?
Shouldn't be all that hard to calculate. The total budget divided by the census should give you the...
Well, different calculations, so I'd want to go back and look at some of the calculations on that, because it's not a stagnant population, we admit, people. It's
right.
If you're looking at the census and say it's 600 patients, we don't just serve 600 people a year. There's many people admitted, come in for forensic evaluations, discharged.
Right.
I'd want to look at those figures.
I keep going back to our presentation on Wednesday about Fairview and how expensive it was to keep folks in that institution, and I think we want to think about this institution and how much it costs, and we'll be pleased to see those figures from you, Greg.
Sure.
And then how the services can be provided perhaps in the community, where, as I recall, some of these are aided by federal funds. Is that correct, Richard?
Yes, sure.
And do we get federal funds for the state hospital?
Yes, for a portion of the population, yes.
Do you have any idea what proportion that might be? Well, you can get back to us. I'm asking you questions that you weren't prepared for. But if you'd get that back to us, that would be helpful. Representative Wyden, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you've prompted a bunch with comments, because one of the things it'd be nice to know as well is, because obviously some patients cost more than other patients, too, in the hospital. So you'd need to break it down to what the severity of their disability is. But my question, back online with what we were talking about with community and everything, and this is something, Richard, when I went to your mental health forum that we had, to me it's something I've thought about, because it's real easy for me to receive a paycheck from the state and go out and see somebody who has a mental health issue. But it's creating a program in the community like AA, and I brought that up in there, and I was approached by several people after that are suffering with mental health issues, that say, yes, that's exactly what we do need. And something that kind of comes to mind is similar to our adult foster care homes, but something like that with mental health. Is that kind of what you would be thinking, where we had someone supervised in there, encouraging, helping them deal with their problems, get back into the workforce and back on to where they can take care of themselves? I mean, that's kind of what I've thought would be the best way to handle this. I don't know. You've been involved a lot longer, and listening to you speak, it sounds like you might be on the same page with that, possibly.
Representative Widener, Chair Tomei and Gilliam, there are so many aspects of what goes into good mental health recovery that we could spend several hours going through the part to it. It's really important that there's a variety of kinds of services for people, including, and particular at certain points, peer support services to help people stay independent in the community. We know a lot from the alcohol and drug world about the role of self-help organizations, 12-step programs. And there are similar things for people with mental illness, dual diagnosis, anonymous being one of the main ones, where there, I think there are almost in every county, in every community, there's meetings going on. But the richness of services have to be calibrated to what the person's needs are. So I've had experience in a previous life where we provided very intensive services that were delivered to somebody where they lived. So a model like that is important for some. For others, it may be that they actually need the assistance of living in a foster home, and it may be because of their brain damage and other conditions that this may be a lifelong condition for them. Most people, however, recover from the major effects of mental illnesses and addiction and can live quite independently in the community. We want to make sure that we're providing them right level of service at the right time, not more, because in the case of housing people too long in residential services, they end up being institutionalized, and it becomes very difficult to live independently. So our job really is to make sure that we're doing the best job of getting people what they need when they need it.
Yeah. Follow up? That was kind of, I didn't mean that they would be in the foster home forever, but yeah, kind of as a gateway for a lot of the people that are on the streets dealing with mental health issues, that they just need a way out. They need that hand up, someone to reach out and, you know, stop showing up at the soup kitchen every week and getting the free food, but teach them how to start doing it for themselves and how to get back on their feet. And that's kind of something that's been in my mind. And I've talked with different churches and different places about putting something together like this, but I'm just wondering if this is something where we should sit down, because it seems like at the legislative level we keep putting band-aids here and there, and we've never really went through and say, hey, let's gut this thing and redo it right, because you've been in this for a long time, you know how it should probably be functioning, to where we get rid of a lot of the waste and we actually do this program right, rather than keep throwing band-aids at it like we've done for the last 50 years.
I would love to come and talk with you up in more depth about this individually, because I spent about 30 years dealing with homeless people with addictions and mental illness, and have, I think, a pretty clear understanding what the pathway through this is. And I would say the state's headed in the right direction, but there are things that we need to do differently.
I think that would be terrific.
Let's get it done.
That would be a very productive meeting. That would be great. Thank you for offering, Richard. Representative Thompson, you have another question? Then I think we're going to move on.
Thank you. Do you have enough statutory and rule flexibility to be innovative? I'm asking that question in the vein that oftentimes I find people like yourself have really great ideas on how we could better spend the money, but you're hampered by, we can't do that.
Representative Thompson, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, I think there are so many rules and regulations in the system when it comes from the federal government to the state government to down to local communities, plus all of the accountability requirements that everybody has, that wending your way through that regulatory environment is a challenge. And I believe that one of the themes that I'm hearing from a variety of places is that we have to figure out what is a more efficient way to be doing this. Certainly our experience in the demonstration projects we started in Central Oregon with Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County shows that there are a number of barriers that could be changed in order to deliver those services. And I think the effort currently going on now to integrate long-term care, mental health, addiction, and health care are going to have to be confronted with what kind of waivers are necessary in order to make a more rational system out of this. So I believe that we are going to have to spend time in this session going through those things.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard and Suzanne, right? And Greg,
yes.
I'd like for us to spend a lot of time on the hospital. And so we have three bills we're supposed to be hearing today. Would you be willing to come by at a later time and let us spend more time on this issue?
I certainly would.
Great. Sure. I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do you have any quick questions of anyone here before we let them go? Yes,
Representative. I'm really intrigued with this budget thing, and I think we'll hear about it, but it seems to me you're spending about $1,500 per patient day, taking your whole budget roughly by the days. Does that sound roughly right? All right, well, I'll hear about it in the ways of the subcommittee.
Well, I'd like
surprised
to
know. I'm surprised you don't have those numbers at your fingertips.
Representative,
that really shocked me.
Representative Greenlee, I think that we're being very cautious because we're right now preparing ways and means, and those. My plan was to present a few numbers here, but I think we're going to hold this till next week when we can answer that question more definitively.
I can say in my experience as hospital administrators working with them over the last 40 years or so, there wasn't a single one I ever met who didn't know what the average cost per day in their institution was, until now.
I think Mr. Roberts knows what the numbers are. I just think he doesn't want to put them out on the table.
He can't trust us with those numbers. I understand that.
Thank you.
I'll send an Oregonian reporter. Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative, I think we're going to stop that line.
Good idea. Good idea.
Thank you.
Before I get into real trouble.
Right. He's getting a little excited.
And we would also like to, I see Mickey Logan is here, and perhaps we could have some more information in the future about the USDOJ and what's going on with the hospital.
Yes.
We would like to have information about that. And even though we are not the Ways and Means Committee, I think it's appropriate for this committee to hear about the costs of the hospital, et cetera, and treating people in the community. So I would appreciate it if you could help us get that information.
I've taken notes that we'll provide that.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for coming, Mickey. It's always good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. And I would hope that if you have any further questions that arise as you think about these issues, that you will contact them, and I know that they would be happy to give you either the information personally or provide it to the administrator of our committee, and so that we can all get it. So with that, I will close the public hearing on informational hearing on the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority. Yes, thank you. So I'm going to open. Am I just doing an announcement? Okay. So we had a possible work session on House Bills 2051 and 2052. So 2051 we're going to carry over until Monday, and hopefully we'll get the fiscal on that. And 2052 we'll announce that we'll hear at a later date. Right? Okay. Thank you. All right. With that, we will open up a public hearing. Is Representative Kotek here? Okay. We will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2107. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2107 modifies statutory language to clarify that a physician or provider can disregard the declaration for mental health treatment in the state hospital or secure intensive community inpatient facility for those patients committed under forensic statutes.
Thank you. And we have Carol Goodenluck, Greg Roberts, Megan Connie. It's always good to see you, Megan. I haven't seen you for a while. And if you'd just come on up. And then we have Mary Botkin also on the list. We'll have you next, Mary, wherever you are.
Oh, there she is right there.
Okay. Well, okay, we only have three chairs, so. Who are we missing? Did we lose Greg? Oh, there's Greg. Great. Okay.
Between the two hands. Good morning.
Okay. Greg, do you want to start out this?
Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee, again, my name is Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here to testify on HB 2107. It's related to mental health advance directives. It was a pre-session filed bill brought forth by the Oregon Health Authority, Addictions and Mental Health Division. The statutory change in the bill is to fix an oversight hospital staff identified and confirmed with our General Counsel Division of the Oregon Attorney General's Office. Mental health advance directives are a legal option for those persons suffering from mental illness to direct facilities or to allow another attorney, in fact, a designated person, to direct a facility to provide mental health treatment as the person desires. The mental health advance directive is completed when a person is considered competent and takes effect when a person becomes incapable of decision-making. The current statute specifies that a healthcare facility such as Oregon State Hospital may disregard the directive only when persons are committed to the Oregon Health Authority under civil commitment statutes. There is no current direction given in statute that identifies how these directives should be handled for individuals who are committed to the state hospital under forensic statutes. It is very common for patients to refuse medication while they're at the hospital. This can result in prolonged hospitalization and significant suffering associated with exacerbations of acute symptoms of mental illness. Patients may be involuntarily medicated in some circumstances through a formal judicial process after steps have occurred as prescribed in the administrative rule. In summary, HB 2107 is designed to align the statute so that the Oregon State Hospital handles the Mental Health Advance Directive in the same manner for patients who are civilly committed or committed under forensic procedures. If this alignment is not done, the result may be that the state hospital is unable to medicate these patients appropriately using the contested case process, which would increase the length of stay, increase the use of seclusion and restraints, and increase the potential for assaults on other patients and staff. I thank you for your time, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions? This witness?
I will want to speak to it at some point, but not
sure. This. Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Either of you, I think Mary, you were, or Carol, you were first.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairs Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee. I'm a little bit nervous. My first time testifying before you, so just
you're
put that
doing
up.
Great. We're a very informed.
Thank
group.
You. You do have the one of the persons told me. I wanted you to know that you have my written testimony.
Yes, we do.
In front of you. Good. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Carol, if you could not read from the
I'm not
text,
going to. I'm,
wonderful.
I'll get to the bullet. I have my 16 point here for 6
Got
or
it.
12 points.
Terrific.
Summaries. I just by my name is Carol Gunlock. I'm a retired critical care nurse, semi-retired critical care nurse with 30 years of direct patient care experience as well as administrative experience in cardiology services for a major hospital system. So I consider myself fairly well-versed in the ins and outs of working with advanced directives and even psychiatric advanced directives. For the purposes of my presentation or my discussion, I'm just going to reference directives because it gets confusing, PAD, Oregon's Declaration of Mental Health, so on and so forth. But I wanted to, you know that I did have a little bit of professional background and experience, at least in working directly with these documents and the issues that come up with them. I am also a family member who is a duly appointed power of attorney for healthcare and attorney, in fact, for mental health care for my brother, who has lived with serious and persistent mental illness for many years. Finally, I also have witnessed on a first-hand basis the very serious untoward medical consequences that can and do occur when directives of the rights of the surrogate decision-maker are ignored by the mental health system. in my brother's case, it was had nearly fatal consequences, and I've discussed with some of you before some of the issues of why I feel so strongly about this. As such, I've been asked to speak to you on behalf today in opposition to House Bill 127, and behalf of the Oregon Chapter and National Alliance of Mental Illness, our 16 affiliates and over 1,500 members today. I also want you to know that NAMI Oregon has been working very closely with our fellow advocacy organizations, both Disability Rights Organization and Mental Health of America, as we've attempted to understand the pros and cons and different points of views. Legalities is actually quite a complex issue. I've been working on this for almost 2 years, but intensively when we knew this bill was coming up, we've all been meeting. We all are submitting. Bob was not able to be here today, but he submitted written testimony. And Megan is here on behalf of Mental Health of America, so to give our opinions. You know, Mr. Roberts has just, you know, given an overview, technical fix, bring things in alignment, and so on and so forth with House Bill 2107. And I guess from NAMI Oregon's standpoint and my personal standpoint is, quite frankly, we're somewhat surprised that they would even consider proposing this bill, given the division's commitment to recovery-oriented care. And we were somewhat caught off guard that this was going to be proposed. And moreover, we're somewhat concerned with the facts, rationales, and assumptions that they've used to justify their reasoning for this. So I'd like to give you our sort of standpoint on this. One of the, I guess first and foremost, the primary tenet and principles of a recovery-oriented system is the right of patient self-determination. Laws, Oregon laws, federal laws, all grant that right for a patient to make their own medical decisions, all capable patients to make their medical decisions. It gets somewhat complex when you're dealing with cognitive impairment and sort of the range of how impaired are you, how incapable are you. There are challenges, I'm not denying, of using advanced directives, but but the law is very clear as far as we know, and I'm going to let Bob Joondiff go into it, but I'll just tell you from a layperson standpoint, I look at the Federal Self-Determination Act. I've worked on a committee at the hospital with some of your staff, you know, trying to wade through what we can share and what have you. But it's very clear that patients have the right to refuse medication. Patients have the right to make their own determinations known. Patients also have the right to execute an advance directive and appoint a circuit decision maker in a proactive basis in preparation. And in fact, in most chronic illnesses, you would advise, if you have a heart condition, diabetes, you want somebody to know, somebody to be there in your stead to represent your voice, especially given the fact that the hospital does have a process where they can override whatever's being presented, but at least you want that information at your fingertips. So it's a little bit confusing. It also seems to be against, I guess one of our first points was that both law supports the right to self-determination, SAMHSA statements, the Joint Commission has a new standard that says PADs must be honored within mental health institutions, just put forth. I cited it with my documents. And candidly, the division's own statement on resiliency and recovery points to the primacy of self-determination. And so it's kind of, in our opinion, we view the ability to not honor a patient as kind of a catch-22. We give you the right to make your directives known, to appoint a circuit decision maker. But boy, when you need it, or when you're most vulnerable, and you're in the hospital, you want to, I'm sorry, but you can't use it, is kind of our issues with this concept. I personally don't have an issue with overriding and so on and so forth, but I have a big issue with a patent disregard of a document. How to resolve that legally and all, it's complex.
If you could sum up,
sure,
that would be great.
I guess, you know, we question in my written testimony, I question whether they even have the authority to do this by the current law, and I think Bob addresses that as well. And I guess to disregard, and I guess in third, we've thought about this. We'd hoped to just have some administrative meetings to resolve this, but when this bill came before you, we'd now like to say we'd like to have some time to meet, resolve between the advocacy community and others, at least this is NAMI's solution to this problem. Table 2107 at this point, so that some of these issues can be resolved. And I thank you for, I cited numerous statutes and what have you. So if you have a need for additional information, I'm happy to provide it for you, or the links to the various websites are there.
Thank you
for the opportunity.
Thank you for coming. You did a great job.
Thank you.
Megan.
Thank you. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to testify before you. My name is Megan Cahay. I'm the president of Mental Health America of Oregon. I'm wanting to present to you a slightly different perspective than you've heard so far, because I'm a person who has a serious mental illness, and I also have a declaration for mental health treatment. So I'm talking to you in a very personal way from my own experience. What I want to make clear is that in making a declaration for mental health treatment, when a person makes that, when I made mine, I put into that the things that work best for me in helping keep me well or make me well when I'm in an acute episode not doing well. I know the medications that have been helpful. I know the ones that I've had bad side effects to. I know whether or not electroconvulsive therapy has been useful for me or not. I also know who I want to take care of my dog. If I can't take care of her, things like this go into a psychiatric advance directive or declaration for mental health treatment. Now, if I become incapacitated and do something terrible and end up a forensic patient at the Oregon State Hospital, I still, at a better time, thank you. I still at a better time, I apologize for that. I still at a better time have made known what works for me. And I think it's really important. I know for myself that for me to do better when I'm not doing well, I need to have hope. And I also need to trust my caregivers, the people that are there trying to help me. Now, granted, even with the psychiatric advance directive the way it is right now, there could be an override and people can be forcefully medicated. And I do have problems with that, although I know that there are probably situations where it would be warranted. But that's not what I'm talking about here. That remains whether or not we have this bill. This bill is not a simple housekeeping bill. This is about basic rights, and also about what helps people be in recovery when they're not doing well. Therefore, I ask you to please oppose this bill. And with all I just want to acknowledge Mr. Greg Roberts' well-meaning intention with this, and say thank you to him for his work at the Oregon State Hospital. And thank you all. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Megan. Any quick questions?
Thank you.
Anyone here? Representative Wagner, and then Representative Thompson.
Yes, overrid the vice chair. thank you, Chair.
This time.
Megan, just to help me here a little bit, one of the things that I like to do myself, or when I, and it's working, I do a lot of coaching work with youth and different groups like that, but does a kind of a risk-reward program work better for mental health patients, do you think? I mean, with you being through the care and being there, that's why I want this question directed towards you, because I want to know what has been very successful for you.
Representative Widener, you speak of a risk-reward, so I'm not familiar.
It would be similar to, hey, Megan, if you get up today and you're here by 8 o'clock and breakfast and you rinse your plate, you know, you're going to get to have whatever you need to whatever treat you want, versus if you don't get up, you're not going to get breakfast and you won't get to wear these shoes today or something like that.
Well, yeah, I wish it were that simple.
I'm trying to break it down simple, but I know it's much more complicated.
You know, with all respect, it's really not is not a simple thing. If when I have been in the hospital and I have not wanted to get out of bed in the morning, it hasn't been people saying, if you get out of bed and come eat breakfast, you'll be able to watch TV or have a phone call. That won't move me out of bed. It's someone coming and talking to me and saying, you know, what's going on? And what would help? You know, what would help you go in? And they might go and sit with me at the breakfast table because I might be scared about being there, be scared of other people or something more like that. So if that staff person comes and spends some time with me doing something that I find very hard, I might find it easier. So that kind of thing, I think, is one of the possible dynamics. You know, sometimes it can be as simple as, you know, like Pavlov, if you press the lever, you'll get a pellet or if the bell rings. But, you know, human beings are much more complex than that, especially people who are in an acute episode. The way out of that acute episode, what has helped me has been people who will listen, has been having peers who will listen, has been having care providers who are non-judgmental, but who will come down to where my experience is and not necessarily tell me what to do, but let me find what I need to do and who will respect and support me. Thank you.
Thank you. That's exactly where I wanted to go with this. So then if I may have a follow-up with Greg. Greg, what kind of brought this about? Is there severe cases where you just can't talk to somebody to communicate with them to get them to that point, or what's the purpose kind of driving this bill?
Representative Widener and co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, I'm not aware of any specific cases that have brought this to the forefront. It's just the realization that the current law applies only to a certain category of the patient population and not the other portion. So we are looking to establish one consistent process for the entire patient population.
Is it, if I may follow up, mm-hmm. is it one specific process? Because the way you kind of started there, it sounds like expand it to another group of people. So is it expand?
The current statute applies to the civilly committed
yes.
patients and not to the forensic patients. So we're looking to have the one process for all patients, not to expand or change anything further beyond that.
Okay, but, thank you.
Representative Thompson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I'll direct this to Megan because she's my constituent, but I would like to hear from each of you. Is there any middle ground on this bill?
Hmm?
Is there something we could do to make the bill work for the hospital but yet address the issues of the mental health community?
Yeah, I'm all in favor for middle ground. When it comes to basic rights, I believe we need to really decide on the side of rights. I think the middle ground is where there's flexibility where upon which the hospital can actually have a process and has a process to forcibly drug a person if it's really absolutely necessary. And that's a very metered out, judicious way that those decisions are made. It's not just an automatic, we can do this. It's, you know, there's a process. And I think that process really should take, you know, does take into account that there are times, but what we, you know, really, it's a firm stand on the side of rights that I would take. And to me, that's not really gray.
And one clarification on this, is my understanding, is it correct, that this already applies to the civilly committed population? So
correct.
We're just adding in the forensic side to something that's already being done. So in order to meet your interests, we'd have to rescind the present situation completely. Is that true?
Mr. Roberts, I think that's directed to you.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes, again, to be clear, we're not looking to change anything about the existing processes that apply to advance directives for civilly committed patients, we're looking to apply those same standards to the entire patient population, including forensic patients. So the procedures, the examples discussed here this morning about involuntary medication, for example, would still apply. The person would have an advance directive, and any issues about overriding the advance directive, the procedures that already exist would remain in place and not change, but they would apply to the entire population.
Okay. Are you needing to address this?
Well, I'm happy to answer any questions about the laws, about the policies.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. May I make a comment, sir?
We need to move on, but quick comment, maybe.
Yes. I just want to say, in terms of being a forensic patient as opposed to a civilly committed patient, you know, a person who has mental illness, like, I could possibly do something, and I would hate to think that I would do anything, but I could possibly do something and end up a forensic patient. But I would want to think that when I was doing better and doing the proactive, responsible thing of making a declaration for mental health treatment, that that would carry over and help me get well.
Thank you.
If I may, Madam Chair, I just to echo you asked, I strongly agree with Megan's about patients' rights. I also think the other point of this is that it's a dangerous practice to not at least allow a voice in the room. Megan knows what works for her. If she trusts somebody and has appointed them a surrogate, she should have the right to have that voice at the table. You can take your process, your informed consent process, so on and so forth, and override us, fine. But the right to have a voice, the patent disregard of a declaration, I'll let you know, to my knowledge, at least when I was working on the committee at the hospital, had no policy whatsoever regarding declarations of mental health. None.
Thank you so much. We need to move on, and I really appreciate you, both of you, coming, and Greg, of course, you're closer by, but I know these people are traveling, and we will be having you back again, so I think there might be more questions we'll
thank you
to you. And Mickey, thank you for being here. We may have more questions for you too later. Thank you. And Mary, and is there anyone else who is wanting to testify on this? If not, Mary will be our last presenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chairs, and Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent the doctors and the nurses who work at the Oregon State Hospital. And I just want to make a quick statement on their behalf. We view the Oregon State Hospital, or hope to view it, in its new reincarnation with Mr. Roberts in charge, as a place for healing and stabilization and hopefully recovery and release. Every time a client comes into our care, they have already sort of exceeded the ability of the community to deal with their problems, and they have exceeded their own ability for dealing with their problems, and so they come to us in a state of where they are very sick and need a great amount of assistance and treatment. It assumes that a client has the reasonable ability to make rational decisions about what is best for their care when they are in a moment of irrational behavior. And it is our goal to assist them in making rational decisions. We hope that in the process of treatment, in the process of active treatment, we can assist our clients in understanding the consequences of decisions and choices that they make. And at a point where these clients are not able to make those kinds of rational decisions, we think it makes sense for the doctors and the nurses who are trained to assist to be able to make those decisions. Oftentimes, clients who choose not to take medication compromise the security and the safety of other clients. They compromise the active treatment of other clients. And if one client uses all of the resources in a moment where they are not medicated, of the staff, it deprives the rest of the clients of their rights to treatment. And it is our goal to make sure that everybody who comes into the state hospital receives the same level of active treatment that they deserve and that they are, that they have a right to expect, and that we have an obligation to provide. And so we think that this bill makes a tremendous amount of sense. Currently, if you have a PSRB client, I mean, these are the most, these are the sickest and most dangerous clients that we have. And it is not reasonable to expect that other clients should be placed at risk because a person decides that they don't want to take their medications. That's just not okay. And, you know, our staff and our members certainly do not medicate without thought. And the doctors are trained professionals who deal with this this client base all the time, every day. And so, you know, it is problematic when clients choose to refuse medications without understanding that if they refuse those medications, they will be sicker longer and release will be more problematic for them.
Thank you, Mary. Colleagues, we have two more bills, and I know we have questions. We can bring, Mary is in the building all the time. We can bring her back.
And I'll be happy to come see you.
And we can bring Mr. Roberts back and Ms. Logan if we need more information about the law. It sounds like we do need to have another hearing, so we will arrange that. Certainly we won't have a work session planned for a while, so we will get more information for everybody. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2107 and open up. Is Representative Kocek, is she coming down? What is her desire?
Her LA is watching the TVs for when you get to 2398 or when you want to hear that, and she will come down.
Who do we have? I'm sorry, if you would excuse me just for a minute. Could you look to see who we have testifying on 2108? We have quite a few people here wanting to testify on it. Has anybody come from 50 miles? Okay, nobody. And could you check on 2138 also, please? Okay, I think what we're going to do is have hearings on both of these bills. There will be time limited. So I know you're not going to be having all the time that you need to give us all the information that you want to. But we're going to give each bill 15 minutes. So I'm going to open up public hearing on... Is this okay with you?
Yes.
Thank you. Open up public hearing on 2108. Jennifer?
House Bill 2108 establishes standards and procedures in the Juvenile Code for determining fitness of youth to proceed on a delinquency petition, requires the Oregon Health Authority to develop guidelines on how to conduct an evaluation of fitness of the youth to proceed and administer a program to provide restorative services to youth who are determined unfit to proceed and who present substantial probability of gaining or regaining fitness.
Thank you. So we have four people signed up, and I'm going to ask all four people. Can we can take up one of these, or maybe we can't. Can we move one of these chairs up? Do they move, or are they attached?
Looks like they're attached.
You can. Okay, great. Thank you.
No.
So we're going to call up Kurt Miller, Bill Buska, Mark McKetney, and Wendy Johnson. And again, I apologize for the short amount of time for testimony, but Boy, it is in a fast lane.
The end of June is coming fast.
What's that?
The end of June is coming fast.
Yes, it is. It is. We've got a lot to do. So we realize that you have a lot of testimony, and we may have to call you back again for another hearing, but I did want to get this subject out so that at least we could start talking about it and thinking about it. So, again, now you have about 12 minutes, so I'm going to ask you to speed up, talk fast, and whoever wants to go first.
Co-Chair Tomei, I'll go first. And Co-Chair Gilliam, my name is Bill Bushka. I'm the manager of Children's Mental Health Services for the Addictions and Mental Health Division within the Oregon Health Authority, and here to provide testimony on 2108. This bill was pre-session filed by our division, and for a number of years we've worked with the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Code Revision Work Group to develop language that's contained in this bill. This bill, I'll try to be as really as quick as possible and give a basic overview. This bill directly addresses a current gap in the juvenile code for young people to be able to aid and assist in their defense when they are facing legal charges. It basically outlines the court and legal process that's to be provided. It provides guidance on the evaluations for an individual to be evaluated for their ability to aid and assist. It provides the provision of restorative services for those individuals when they're found not able to aid and assist. A little bit about some of the work that the health authority would do underneath the law. We would be providing training standards, report guidelines for the evaluator, so around being able to evaluate a youth for their ability to aid and assist, and then we would be providing a list to the court of evaluators who are able to provide the evaluations under those guidelines. We would be actively providing through a contractor to provide restorative services, and a key value of ours in the law is to both provide the evaluations and the restorative services to where the youth is located. So there's no need to create a facility or for a youth to go to a facility, but we would make sure the evaluators and the restorative services would go to where the youth is at. So I think that's enough basic outline for what the bill contains, and I'm happy to come back or answer further questions about the law.
Thank you. We're going to move on. Thanks for being quick.
Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. Thank you for hearing this bill today. You have in before you two documents from the Law Commission. The first is a one-page summary, and then right behind it is a longer report from the Law Commission. And then there are some appendices, a Linn County opinion, and then the statutes from the criminal aid and assist statute. And the reason those are provided are that Oregon does not have an aid and assist set of statutes for juveniles. But we do have one for criminals, for the adults. Mm-hmm. And before, we wouldn't have attached those as an appendices, but because of the Linn County opinion, it says those statutes are applicable to juveniles, and that creates its own set of problems because they have different timelines for adult court. It generally has you go to the state hospital for the evaluation, and things of those aren't appropriate from our work group's perspective and the commission's perspective to use an adult system for juveniles. And so the materials explain all that. This is our first time in front of the Human Services Committee on this topic, but the Law Commission was created to fill gaps in the law and provide nonpartisan support from to basically assist the legislature. We were created in 1997. On the letterhead, you see who our commissioners are, and we're from all three branches of government. Your legislative appointments from the House are Representative Chris Garrett and Lane Chatterley are your House appointments, and this bill does come with the unanimous recommendation of that commission. Usually we're in the Judiciary Committee, and this bill has passed out of the Judiciary Committee the last two sessions. Unfortunately, the last two sessions, it's died in the Ways and Means process. The commission is here to recommend how you should improve the law, but unfortunately, there's not a real champion for getting the funding for this project, because it really affects each part of the system. It affects the juveniles who need this service. It affects the public safety community, because if a juvenile is not able to aid and assist, some courts are dismissing the case and they're going back into the community, and other counties are going ahead and adjudicating the children anyway. It's just a very different process.
Can I just stop you for a minute?
Sure.
Because the adults do, some of them will go into the state hospital if they've committed a crime, when there is suspicion that they'd committed this crime while they were mentally ill. So they will go into an aid and assist somewhere, possibly in the state hospital. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, the adult system,
for
the adults, if an issue is raised when they're charged that there is an aid and assist problem, they generally are sent to the state hospital or the intensive secure, whatever.
Right. Until they're prepared mentally to be able to go
correct.
To court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I just sort of
want right.
to make this clear to the committee. So there is provision for the adults. There is no provision currently for juveniles
right.
to go through that same kind of process. So there is no provision for them to go into a situation where they can be aided and assisted until they're ready to go for their own defense in when they're being adjudicated.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, that's correct. Some would squabble with that, because constitutionally you have a requirement to be able to aid and assist under the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. So we don't have anything in statute, but they have a right to have to make
this. They have a right to have it, but they don't have it at this point.
They don't have it in the sense of having a process in statute.
Right. And the problem, I'm sorry, committee, but as I understand it, the problem is that the Judiciary Committee will agree that, yes, this is really important, it should happen, but when it goes to Ways and Means Committee, it does cost money in order to provide this ability, and it fails in Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, correct.
Okay, thank you. Okay, quick summary, and then we're moving on to the next
question. Members of the committee, the reports and materials before you really explain how the process would work, deadlines along the line, because in juvenile court, you want a quicker process, and these children are changing all the time. The adult process has much longer deadlines. In fact, there are not a lot of deadlines for when the report has to be done, and it's 180 days for follow-up evaluations and such. And the juvenile process provided by this bill is much narrower timelines to get treatment quicker. The fiscal is usually the problem of the bill. The Law Commission recommended a PSRB bill for juveniles, and that has passed in a couple sessions ago. And so these two issues overlap, as you know, in the mental health community often, and this is just the other piece that's still missing.
Okay, thank you. Mark, welcome, for whomever.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Miller, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. In general, we support the idea of a new process for fitness proceed in juvenile proceedings. As Wendy pointed out, we do have some issues right now where what we do is we follow generally the adult statutes in order to deal with this issue, and normally juveniles are moved to a secure treatment facility because they are still alleged to have committed crimes, and these are some very serious crimes, non-measure 11 since they're 14 or younger, but it could be things such as rape, arson, mm-hmm. or even possibly murder. The largest problem I would see that the District Attorneys Association would have with the bill lies in Section 4, where it says that a youth may not be moved from their current placement for the sole purpose of an evaluation. I think the largest problem that we see with that is if this youth is being lodged in pre-adjudication detention, so he's housed in a detention facility, that means that we couldn't move him to a secured residential treatment facility for the evaluation. I think that that seems to say that we have to keep the youth in the more restrictive setting of detention rather than the less restrictive mental health setting, which probably would be better for the youth. In that section, under paragraph 1, it states that you shouldn't move a youth unless it's in the youth's best interest and it's necessary for the evaluation. I think that that's enough of a standard for us to go by. And so if that youth is necessary to be moved out of detention for the evaluation, we shouldn't put that limit on them not to be able to move for a treatment evaluation. If the legislature's intent is for that movement not to be from a less restrictive placement like a home setting, to a more restrictive placement like a residential facility, then that could easily be accomplished by just placing, modifying paragraph 2 to state a youth shall not be moved from a less restrictive placement to a more restrictive placement for the purpose of an evaluation, because I think that that would be a great idea.
Current, this bill is going to go on to the Judiciary Commitment, so, Committee, I mean Commitment, Committee, so I think your argument might be better made there. So I'm going to stop you if that's okay.
Thank you.
Hi, Mike. And the reason I brought it here was I think it's important that we realize what's happening with juveniles who are mentally ill and committing crimes, but it will go to judiciary to be dealt with more thoroughly.
Mike. Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the executive director of Youth Rights and Justice. We have recently changed our name from the Juvenile Rights Project. For the last 35 years, we've represented 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system, including children in foster care and youth facing delinquency charges. This is an issue that we have had to struggle with repeatedly, and it is a problem that we hope will finally be remedied in the 2011 session. I don't want to repeat things that have already been said, but I find it interesting following the last bill that we were debating how decisions are made when a person may not be able to make rational decisions. What we're talking about in this bill is whether or not we are going to force someone to proceed through a complicated legal process and make decisions that will impact them for the rest of their lives when we know they are probably not rational and able to make decisions and understand the process and help their attorney make decisions that will lead to the best outcome for them. I think a reasonable analogy would be if you were in a foreign country where they speak in a language that bears no resemblance to English, and you found yourself involved in their justice system under arrest, facing some kind of prosecution that you didn't understand, and you were not provided an interpreter to help you understand the charges against you, or an interpreter to help you communicate effectively with your attorney who is there to represent your rights. That's basically the circumstances that youth find themselves in when they suffer serious mental illnesses or developmental disabilities. They have barriers that prevent them from understanding both the process and the consequences that may result from a trial or a plea. And it's very important that they receive treatment and education, if possible, to make them competent to proceed and able to make decisions and able to assist their attorney in representing them effectively. Our attorneys are ethically obligated to follow the wishes of their clients and to take direction on key decisions and strategy in a case. Just like if you went and hired an attorney, you would expect them to do what you wanted them to do rather than to substitute their opinion and their judgment about what's best for you. Attorneys rely on the direction of their clients, and they rely on some basic understanding on the part of their clients to make that direction meaningful. And this bill will help provide the opportunity to do that and remedy a flaw that we've had in our justice system for youth for, by my calculation, at least 40 years since the Adult Aid and Assist Statute was first put in place. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. You're a great advocate for kids. I wish we had time to hear more about this. It's a very important piece of legislation, and we'll hope that it will be heard in the judiciary, and hopefully we can get funding for this. So thank you all. Sorry that we cut your testimony short, and thank you for the materials you gave us. With that, I will close the Human Service or the House the hearing, public hearing on House Bill 2398, and I'm closing a hearing on House Bill 2108 and opening up a hearing on House Bill 2398. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. So, Jennifer.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2398 removes the option for the Oregon Health Authority in contracting with prepaid managed care health services organizations to provide services in a medical assistance program and to contract with separate providers for physical and mental health services.
Thank you. And we have Richard Harris, Judy Monk, Cindy Becker, and Megan Conahy. And do we? Representative Kotick, I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. Come right on up. Richard, come on up. Judy, and then we'll have Cindy and Megan in a minute. Okay, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44 from North Portland. Thank you very much for providing the opportunity to start a conversation with House Bill 2398 this morning. I will be brief. This was a committee bill that was introduced by the Interim Committee on Health Care at my request. It was my attempt to say we've been doing a lot of talking about the importance of integrating physical and mental health. We need a vehicle to, from a legislative perspective to get started on the conversation during the session. You know, when you send a concept down to legislative council, you never know what comes back. But this is very straightforward. It says, you know, in the past we have asked to the fullest extent possible contracting with managed care plans for the Oregon Health Plan clients. This says to the fullest extent practicable contract with managed care plans that integrate physical, mental, and dental, all services. So we can get at the issues around integrating mental health. You've been doing a great job. You'll continue to, I think, have good conversations here about the mental health system. So this is another piece of that discussion of how we do that. I'm not saying this bill, the way it's written, is perfect. It has a nice, large relating clause, but at least it's a place to get the conversation started. For me, it has always been about the person receiving the services for the client. Why do they need to have multiple plans? If you're on the Oregon Health Plan, you have a physical health provider, a managed care plan, you have a mental health managed care plan, you have a dental care organization that manages your dental care. Where is that conversation that these things can be integrated for one entry point for the person who's receiving the services? And as you know, and you'll hear from the department, the governor has started a very large conversation about health system transformation. There's meetings weekly on the topic. This is part of that. There's a lot of discussion about integration and the role of mental health with physical health, and just here to be helpful and look forward to listening to the conversation. I just want to learn what people think about how we make this happen. So thank you.
Thank you. Can you stay?
Because
I'd like
stay.
To have
I'm
questions
stay.
After these three speak. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good morning. So, for the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Assistant Director for Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm happy to testify today. There's some written testimony, and I will not read it. And actually, Representative Kotek covered the majority of points that I was going to make. Certainly, the coordination of care and the integration of care is one of the top priorities for our division and for the Oregon Health Authority. The idea of realigning health care and long-term care services is a top issue that we're discussing right now. So eliminating fragmentation, integrating service delivery, and the administration of those programs, and also by putting the consumer, the person in the center of that integration efforts is foremost in our thoughts. And recently, as was already mentioned, Governor Kitzhaber has articulated this vision very clearly, calling for a transformed delivery system that will produce higher value, better outcomes through better integrated care. And to that end, the governor has created a health systems transformation team that is currently looking at these issues. That we're working, I think, for several weeks now. We'll be going to the first part of April, I believe. It's every Wednesday from 6 to 9. Some of the members here are on that team. They're getting considering input from a variety of stakeholders from all parts of the state, from different parts of the health system itself. We expect that they will draft a roadmap for us to consider that will help align incentives, help to integrate or point a direction on how we can integrate service delivery and how we can improve health outcomes. And overall enrich the consumer's experience. So we really support the health system transformation team's efforts, and we are prepared to work at implementing whatever those team's recommendations are. And we look forward to this conversation.
Thank you, Judy.
Richard.
Richard Harris, Assistant Director for Addictions and Mental Health, the Oregon Health Authority, co-chair Tomei and Gilliam, and members of the committee. I didn't address this as a major part of my earlier presentation, but the way we manage the mental health system for both adults and children, we're heavily invested in the process of providing the services under the management of the mental health organizations, and they're part of this system of the way we manage forward. We've recently invested additional business with the mental health organizations to manage the adult mental health facilities services, and believe that these organizations are the proper individuals within the mental health system to make sure people get the right level of care. So they're an important component of our present-day system, and we look forward to the discussion about how we're going to do the health care transformation in an integrated way, and believe that the mental health organizations have much to contribute to the system, and it's at present time may not be the exact way things work into the future, but we think they have a significant role in making sure people get the right kind of services at the right time. And certainly the one demonstration project with integration right now in Central Oregon is addressing this very issue about what role the fully capitated managed care plan and the mental health organization manage the services in an integrated way. We're learning a lot about that relationship, but it does require that the mental health organization have a business relationship with the managed care organization, so they know the population, they know what works, they know how to manage that benefit, and have been an integral part of the way that system is working so far in Central Oregon. So we think that this is an area that we'll want to address as we go through the planning for the fully integrated system coming up.
Thank you, Richard. Any quick questions? We have a couple more people set to testify.
I've got one, Madam
Sure.
Chair. I, of course, am eager to get the fiscal back on this before we move forward after this hearing. Pardon me. And I'm also realizing as we hear it, well, although we have four members of the Health Committee on this committee, I'm not so sure this is where this belongs, but can we be reasonably sure as this conversation goes forward? You don't have to answer in numbers right now, but when I see a phrase, produce higher value at lower cost through better integration of care, that's an attractive statement. I mean, I get that. But can we be sure that we're going to see numbers ahead of the bill being passed that give us an indication or a confidence that there is money to be saved and here's where it is?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question, and I think it'll be. I think one of the challenging things about the budget development this session is that there are these reform efforts underway, and how do you actually quantify the savings, quote unquote, that will build into the system? I think for me, it's always about if you provide higher quality care, and I think integration at the ground level will help that. Now, how that looks in terms of who. Where the money goes, and how that affects the delivery. Those are, I think, some of the details we have to deal with. Because by talking about just the plan themselves, that's more of a fiscal entity. What happens mm-hmm. at the ground level? But ultimately, if we can be successful in integrating the care, we'll provide better quality care. In my head, and that's where you find the savings. I think that's a difficult thing, perhaps, to put a fiscal on. And I don't know if Judy wants to comment, but good questions. I think it's a work in progress. Hopefully we'll have some good solid numbers. We have to balance a budget on it if we take this integration aspect as an essential part of balancing the budget this cycle.
Did you want me to do that? Or?
I think there will be more information to come, and we can certainly bring this back at another time, because I think that is a big question to ask. And so thank you so much for testifying, and I know we have two more people who are wanting to testify, and I want to make sure that we have time for that. Thank you so much. So we're having Cindy Becker and Megan Conahy.
Sorry.
No problem.
After all these years, Megan, I'd get it right.
Go ahead.
Co-Chair Tomei and Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to testify. My name is Megan Conahy. I'm president of Mental Health America of Oregon. Oregon is in a time of transition, as you just heard. We are looking very hard at ways to redo mental health delivery and payment that will be more effective for everyone. Right now, some regions are working to combine fully capitated health plans with mental health organizations, with local governments, with inpatient hospital care, health care providers. These regional discussions, like the pilot project in Central Oregon, are doing important work. We believe that this bill could disrupt that important work. In addition, this bill is a financial and administrative structure that would be in place, and we believe that to solve the integration and healthcare problem, we need to look at the whole picture, not just this. This would have the effect of possibly disrupting some good work that's going on and that could be moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. And I'm speaking on behalf of Clackamas County, as well as the Association of Oregon County's Mental Health Programs. I think what's being passed out to you right now is some testimony from Mitch Anderson, who is the Director of the Benton County Health Department, and he is particularly eloquent and also says it a lot better than I can in the short time that I have. But I agree with Megan. Essentially, we oppose this bill not because we oppose integration of mental health and physical health, but we think that this is a little too early. I'm a systems kind of girl, and I think what we need to do is look at the what are the outcomes we want, what are the systems that will help us get there, and then lastly, what's the administrative and financial structure that we need to wrap around this. This bill basically outlines what the administrative and financial structure is, but you can combine these plans and still not get to where you need to go. You still may not get the outcomes. You still may not get the systems. The conversation that's going on across the state in local communities and at the state level is one that needs to happen, and this bill basically jumps over that, and we think that it's at this point it's not the direction we want to go. It may be something that, you know, in the long term, but clearly it's way too early, and we think by combining the physical plans and the mental health plans, you may not get the outcomes you want. It may work against the outcomes you want. Both the physical health plans and the mental health plans have a very important role in this process. We believe it's important that they collaborate. They have equal standing at the table, and this bill would basically send us away from that direction. So any questions?
Any quick questions of either of these two presenters?
Yes, Cindy, in response to another bill I'm interested in, I hear the three mental health systems of the metropolitan area are now moving towards a unified single mental health system. Is that?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, I think that's maybe a little too broad. I do want to say that we do support House Bill 2105, which I think is coming to your committee, which talks about the largest system of the Regional Health Authority. The metropolitan counties have been meeting for the past year, and what we are coming up with are regional strategies. We're not really talking about the structure, but what we're talking about, what are our systems? When someone crosses the border, if you will, they shouldn't have to go into a parallel universe. They should be able to have some pretty standardized things. So we're all working together on how we can align our systems to make them more standardized and also align our outcomes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, anyone else? Looks like they're ready to go. Thank you so much for coming today. And thank you for coming to testify. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2398. Colleagues, I just got a note from my staff that there will be a floor session at 10:30 on Wednesday, so I conferred with my co-chair, and we've agreed to start our committee meeting at 8:30 on Wednesday, so we're out by 10:30 so we can all be on the floor. So I will see you at 9 o'clock on Monday morning. I didn't bring the agenda. Do you remember the agenda for Monday?
I do have that.
I'll see you in my dream.
Well, here he goes again. Oh. Sorry about that.
We'll be continuing our James Tate presentation.
The singing chair.
Okay, wait, folks. Everybody, we're still in committee. Please sit down. If you need to leave, go quietly.
I will be.
Go ahead.
On Monday the 14th, we will be continuing the informational hearing that was initiated by James Taves on the 9th that we heard, so it's the continuation of that, as well as we will be having public hearings on House Bill 2878, 2308, and 2235, as well as three possible work sessions, those being on House Bill 2460, looking at the Dash 1 amendments, House Bill 2057 and 2058, and then earlier we carried over House Bill 2051 for a work session on that.
Okay. Anything for the good of the order? Have a great weekend. With that, I close the committee on human services.